What have you got? The woman asked, walking up to the altar next to him. Not sure, Jason said, pushing the book in front of her. Looks like they were trying to make something, but it's well beyond my expertise. I only found out magic exists today. I'm Jason, by the way. She gave him an odd look.
Farah, thanks again for the rescue.
No worries. I figured the best way out of wherever we are was to get you three to help me. Can you make anything out from that book? She turned her attention back to the pages in front of her.
You're right about them making something, she said, flipping through pages. Something not very nice.
I got that much from context, he said, waving his hand at the chamber around them, black stone reflecting blood-red light from below.
Fair point,
Farah laughed. While she continued examining the book, Jason looked around some more, noticing Gary and Rufus were gone.
Where'd the others go? He asked.
They went to see if those cultists you let off are coming back, Farah said.
I completely forgot about them, Jason said.
Looking around some more, he found a small white sack next to the altar. He picked it up and looked inside. It held a white, crystalline powder. He pinched some between his fingers. Item. Salt. Normal. Common. Ordinary salt. Crafting material. Effect. Common ingredient for use in cooking or magic rituals.
Salt, he said, curiously.
It's good for making quick and easy magic circles, Farah explained, not looking up from the book. A lot of ritual magicians keep some around, me included.
Jason dropped the sack back down next to the altar. There didn't seem to be anything else of interest, but he noticed that Farah had the same iron collar as Gary and Rufus.
I don't suppose the key to your neck thing is here somewhere? Jason said.
Cressida had it, Farah said.
Jason glanced at the wall, where Cressida had crashed into it before dropping out of sight.
Oh, sorry, I pushed her into the pit.
Things would have gone a lot worse if you hadn't, Farah said.
Jason looked over at the stairs leading down.
Can I ask you something about Gary? He asked.
What's that?
Are there a lot of lion people running around, or was he cursed or something?
Farah looked up from the book, again giving Jason a curious gaze.
You've never seen a Leonid before.
I'm not local, Jason said.
That's coming across, she said.
Leonids are a normal race you'd see anywhere in the world.
Good to know, Jason said.
She frowned curiously, but turned back to the book while Jason continued to look around. He peered over the edge, down at the red pit far below. It could have been his imagination, but the room seemed to be getting hotter. The sloshing noise of the pit below seemed louder as well. He spotted Rufus and Gary making their way back up the stairs.
The others are coming back up, Jason said.
That's not good, Farah said.
That seems rude, Jason said.
No, Farah said. I mean, I figured what the cultists were up to.
Bad?
Very bad.
She waited for Gary and Rufus to arrive before explaining.
No sign of the other cultists, Gary said. And one of the wagons was gone. I'm guessing they came back, saw their high priest splattered on the ground, and decided to make a run for it.
Quest. The Blood Feast. Objective complete. Avoid being sacrificed. 1 of 1. Reward. Blood essence. Optional objective complete. Save the other designated sacrifices. 3 of 3. Reward. Awakening Stone of Adventure. Quest complete. 100 Bronze Spirit Coins have been added to your inventory. 1,000 Iron Spirit Coins have been added to your inventory. Jason's eyes lit up at the sight of another essence, but it wasn't the time to start going over his loot, and he closed the window.
I know what they were doing here, Farah told Gary and Rufus.
I'd assume some kind of summoning ritual, Rufus said.
More like trying to create something, Farah said. It's called a sanguine horror, an artificial creature made from alchemy, blood, and things best left unmentioned.
Sounds friendly, Gary said.
It's an apocalypse beast, Farah said. A world ender, A hive mind made up of carrion leeches that rot your flesh as they drain you dry. It feeds on blood to multiply itself, growing in mass and power until there's nothing strong enough to stop it. Then it spreads and spreads until there's nothing left to consume.
Why would anyone create something like that? Jason asked.
They presumably had some way to control it, Rufus said. Use it as a weapon.
That's a big gamble with an apocalypse beast, Farrah said. Maybe that's possible before it gets too powerful. Until it feeds enough to grow strong, it remains vulnerable.
Seems like way too high a chance of going wrong, Jason said.
Speaking of which, Rufus said, have you noticed it's getting hotter in here?
No, Farrah said.
Yes, Jason said, at the same time.
It's more noticeable closer to the pool, Rufus said.
The smell is stronger down there, too, Gary said.
They should probably be tossing us into the blood pit by now, Rufus said. Is something going wrong because we interrupted them?
I think we're overlooking something, Jason said.
What's that? Farrah asked.
Are we sure we interrupted them? They were going to throw the four of us into the pit, right?
Right, Rufus said.
Well, Jason said, how many people did we throw in?
Farrah's pretty brown eyes went wide.
Oh, no,
she said, turning back to the altar and started madly flipping through pages of the book. As the others waited, a screen appeared in front of Jason.
New quest, the Sanguine Horror. Destroy the Sanguine Horror before it becomes too grave a threat. Objective, destroy the Sanguine Horror, 0 of 1. Reward, essence.
Oh, crap, Jason said. Farrah snapped the book shut. It was a hefty tome, and she tucked it under one arm.
I'm pretty sure we just finished their job for them, Farrah said. I don't think they'll appreciate it, Rufus said.
Are we the blood cult now?
Gary asked.
We have to get down there and stop it while it's still weak, Farrah said.
Will the book help?
Gary asked.
Not at all, Farrah said.
If we have to do it, we have to do it, Rufus said. Failing that, we go find someone stronger to deal with it. A lot stronger.
Do you think Emir has arrived yet?
Gary asked.
No, Rufus said. He's weeks away at best.
Then we need to handle this ourselves, Farrah said. I don't trust the competence of the locals.
This guy's all right,
Gary said, dropping a hand on Jason's shoulder that almost knocked him over.
I'm not local, Jason said.
I'm concerned that we don't have our abilities with these collars, Rufus said. You're sure there's nothing in the book about how to fight it?
No, I'm not, Farrah snapped. I've had it for about 8 minutes, and it's written in a language that you haven't even heard of. So maybe there's something in there, but I'm not going to find it by randomly skimming through a few pages.
Did you check for an index?
Gary asked. Farrah's eyes landed on Gary like attack dogs.
I guess there's no time for research, Gary said, heading for the stairs.
Let's go, Rufus said, following after Gary.
Farrah watched them vanish down the steep staircase, then turned to the back of the book. Jason narrowed his eyes as he watched her.
Are you checking for an index?
Chapter 13. This is the part where we step back. The three former captives pounded down the stairs as Jason followed unsteadily behind. As they went down the steep staircase, the smothering heat rose up to engulf them. The air became wetter and heavier until even breathing was a chore. The copper taste of blood felt like it was coating Jason's tongue. The pool was churning loudly, as if something was thrashing just below the surface. The sound echoed throughout the room, especially as they neared the base of the chamber. Near the end of the stairs, they stepped over the corpse of High Priest Darrell, splayed out like a discarded puppet. Jason touched a finger to the body as they passed. Would you like to loot Blood Cult Leader? Jason gave his mental assent as they continued down the stairs. Recovery potion, bronze, has been added to your inventory. 3 gold spirit coins have been added to your inventory.
11 silver spirit coins have been added to your inventory. 216 bronze spirit coins have been added to your inventory. 341 iron spirit coins have been added to your inventory. 471 lesser spirit coins have been added to your inventory. Like Landomir Vane, the High Priest had been holding more than 1,000 coins on his person. As to where he had them stowed away, Jason could only guess. Does everyone here have an inventory? What? Farah asked loudly. It was hard to hear over the wild splashing of the blood pit as they drew closer. Nothing, Jason called back. Jason's real interest was in the recovery potion, which he took from his inventory and tipped down his throat as soon as they reached the bottom of the chamber. Farah saw Jason tip back the potion and threw out a hand in a warning gesture. Jason, don't! The potion was already making its way down Jason's throat. What? Rufus asked, as he and Gary turned around to look. Jason just drank a potion, Farah said.
Right after using a spirit coin, Gary asked.
Is that bad? Jason asked. Actually, why didn't the potion do anything? The others only answered in sympathetic wincing. Moments later, his stomach was filled with cramping pains. He doubled, felt his body desperately wanting to vomit, but unable to do so. You have used a recovery potion while your body is flooded with residual magic. Recovery potion has failed to take effect. You have been afflicted with mana toxin. Mana toxin. Affliction. Poison. Magic. You cannot regain mana. Recovery items will have no effect. You will suffer damage when using mana. Jason groaned. The initial pain passed, but now his stomach felt as awful as his head.
I should have thought to warn you when you didn't know how to use spirit coins, Rufus said. I didn't realize you had any potions. Are you all right?
Honestly, Jason croaked, it isn't going to affect me that much. There's only so much worse I can get.
Rufus nodded, and they turned to the giant pool of churning red liquid, Jason at the back. The space near the large doors leading out was the widest area around the pool, with most of the room having only a small lip between the edge of the red liquid and the wall. When they first entered the chamber, the pool had been churning in the middle. Now the whole thing was like a pot of water, threatening to boil over, splashing red liquid over the sides.
That can't be all blood, right? Jason shouted over the noise.
It isn't, Farah called back. Mostly it's an alchemical mixture, although there is a lot of blood in there. At least a dozen people's worth, maybe 20.
Are you sure we need to fight this monster?
Gary asked.
I'd feel a lot better without this collar on my neck.
We all would, Rufus said.
I'm just saying, Gary said. If I'm going to fight something called an apocalypse beast, I'd rather have my powers.
We do what we can with what we have, Rufus said. Complaining about what we don't have doesn't help.
It isn't actually called an apocalypse beast, Farah said. That's more of an informal category.
That's what we need, Gary said. Pedantry.
Did you say podiatry?
Jason yelled. The churn of the blood-like pool was growing louder and louder. Is there something wrong with your feet?
I said pedantry,
Gary yelled back.
Will you both please shut up? Rufus bellowed.
If we let this entity go, Farah yelled. It will get out and start feeding on the local animals. The more it feeds, the stronger it gets. If it eats its way through a village or a town, then it will get too strong for any of the local powers to stop it.
Can we even do this with our abilities sealed away?
Gary asked.
A handful of cultists is one thing, but a world-destroying blood monster. We have one sword between us. Going for help might not be the worst idea.
Real help is a long way from here, Farah said. The pair looked to Rufus for the deciding vote, who turned his attention to Jason.
You're the reason we aren't all monster soup right now, Rufus shouted. The decision is yours.
Jason looked at the three of them, looking back at him. They clearly had no idea of the magnitude to which he was out of his depth.
What are our actual chances? Jason yelled.
Terrible,
Gary said.
Not good, Rufus said.
Getting better, Farah said, pointing.
They all looked and saw Cressida's body hadn't fallen into the pool, but onto the stone floor at the edge of the chamber. Unfortunately, it was at the far side. That portion of the floor had barely a lip of stone between the pool and the wall. But Cressida had landed lengthways along it.
"She has the key to the colors," Farrah said. "If I can get this thing off my neck, I can blast whatever crawls out of this pit back into blood soup."
"Not sure I'd want to walk around the edge of that pool," Jason said. "Sometimes all your choices are bad, I guess."
"We do it then," Rufus said. "Farrah, go for the key, but be careful of the pool. Ideally, you'll have it and be back before this thing emerges. But Gary and I will stall it if we have to. Jason, what kind of combat abilities do you have?"
"None," Jason shouted. "I was taken out multiple times by a guy with a shovel. I am very bad at fighting."
"That's fine," Rufus shouted back. "Just stay back and try not to die."
Farrah was already moving, putting the book on the ground and setting off around the pool, not waiting for Rufus to finish talking. She carefully hugged the wall, wary of the churning blood pit. Suddenly the blood, which had been roiling like a stormy sea, went as still and serene as a sheltered pond. The roaring noise they had been shouting over immediately fell silent.
"Here we go," Rufus said, his voice an intrusion to the sudden quiet.
Ripples disturbed the edge of the pool, and something emerged from the blood, smaller than they had expected.
"Is that a leech?" Jason asked. It was the right size and shape for a leech, but had the gaping, tooth-ringed maw of a lamprey.
"I do not want that thing crawling up my leg," Gary said.
"I think that's a consensus opinion," Jason agreed. A second leech crawled out, then a third. They came two at a time, then five, ten, until they were spraying out like runoff from a storm drain. They piled on top of one another, forming a squirming, writhing mass.
"We should probably attack while it's still forming," Rufus said to Gary. "I don't suppose you want to go first."
"How am I supposed to fight a pile of leeches?" Gary asked. "I don't think the sword will work. Also, you have our only sword."
Strips of blood-soaked cloth, long and thin, like bandages, started pushing their way out of the leech pile. They wrapped themselves around the leeches, pushing the pile into shape.
"Any idea what it's doing?" Rufus asked.
"None," Gary said. "Jason?"
When Jason didn't answer, they turned to look around and found Jason was no longer there. Gary looked up the stairs and out through the door, seeing no trace of Jason.
"He's done a runner."
There was no time for distraction, and they turned back to the monster forming in front of them. More bloody strips were emerging from the pile, pushing into what they started to recognize as a humanoid shape. It was only a crude approximation, splitting at the seams as leeches spilled out between the bandages. It shambled forward, barely in half steps, shedding leeches as it struggled to keep balance.
"Just stay close enough to keep its attention," Rufus said. "It doesn't seem very fast, and we just have to stall it."
"Or I could punch it," Gary said. "It's a person shape now. I know how to punch people."
"What? No."
Gary's fist slammed into the creature, passing straight between the red-stained bandages and burying itself in the creature's chest. It seemed to have no impact, and Gary staggered back. His arm emerged from the leech monster with a sucking noise, like pulling out a leg that had been stuck in mud. It was covered in leeches, burrowing through his fur to sink teeth into flesh. He staggered about, yelling more in anger than pain as he started ripping them off. Chunks of flesh and fur went with them, clenched in rings of teeth. The bindings around the mass slowly tightened, giving it a more discernibly humanoid shape. It grew faster and more coordinated. Frowning, Rufus tossed aside the sword and picked up the heavy book Farrah had left behind. Winding up as he lunged at the creature, he took a huge two-handed swing. The book slammed into the creature's torso, sending it staggering back. The bindings loosened, leeches once again spilling out of the main mass. The floor was now covered with them, crawling at Gary and Rufus, seeking out their legs. Rufus watched with satisfaction, stepping back from the seeking leeches.
"And she said the book wouldn't help."
Rufus failed to notice the leech crawling over the book until its teeth were buried in his hand, causing him to yelp as the book dropped to the floor. He tore the creature off his hand, a chunk of flesh going with it. He reached down for the book, but there were leeches crawling all over it.
Help!
He heard Farah call out, and he looked around. Gary was still wildly ripping leeches off his now blood-soaked arm. Farah was most of the way around the pool, but bloodied bandages like those wrapping the leech monster had emerged from the pool and were trying to drag her in. Rufus looked around for where he had dropped the sword, then picked it up and hurled it through the air. His confident throw was on the mark, dropping only a few feet from Farah. She hauled back on the bandages trying to pull her into the pool, leaning hard for the sword. The leech monster, in the meantime, had once again tightened its bindings and started walking towards Rufus. He skittered back, still faster than the creature, but its speed increased with every step. Rufus stumbled, falling onto his back with the creature still coming at him, when a bright light descended from above. Jason, starlight cloak floating around him at maximum illumination, drifted down to land between Rufus and the sanguine horror. Tucked under one arm was a small sack. Reaching into the sack, Jason grabbed a fistful of salt and tossed it at the horror. The creature recoiled. Jason did it again, forcing the creature back again.
I'm really glad that worked.
What is that? Rufus asked, getting lightly to his feet.
Salt,
Jason said, throwing out another handful.
Did you use mana while suffering from mana toxin?
Gary asked, wandering over. His arm was drenched in blood and still looked to be bleeding freely, but the leeches were gone and he didn't seem worried.
Seemed time-sensitive, Jason said. Ugh, this hurts. I was pretty much bottomed out on mana in the first place.
Gary looked over Jason's cloak of stars.
You weren't kidding about a power that makes you sparkle.
Suddenly, an explosion of light and noise erupted from the other side of the pool. A bright stream of lava cut through the air like it was coming from a fire hose, crashing into the leech monster. Jason's head pivoted, goggle-eyed, to the source of the blast.
Was that frigging lava?
Farah, collar now gone, held her glowing red hand out towards the creature. She mumbled something and a second stream of lava blasted across the chamber. The blood pit audibly sizzled as the lava seared over it, scouring moisture from the air. After two bursts of white-hot lava, the leech monster was largely destroyed, the bindings holding it together completely unraveled.
This is the part where we step back, Rufus said, putting a hand on Jason's shoulder.
This is the part?
Jason could still feel the heat on his face as he staggered back behind Rufus, then back some more for good measure. He heard chanting from Farah across the pool and looked over. There were several orbs of fire floating around her. One of the cloth strips burst from the pool to grab at her, but was intercepted by an orb burning up on contact. She stopped chanting, and Jason heard a rumbling from the direction of what was left of the leech pile. It started to scatter, but a cascade of lava geysered out of the ground underneath it. Gary, Jason, and Rufus backed off even further as lava spattered around the geyser before it dwindled and came to a stop. Jason looked at the glowing hole left behind, his jaw hanging slack. The red light from the blood pool faded and died, plunging the chamber into darkness. Only Jason's cloak and the remnant glow of lava provided any illumination.
We need to get every leech out, Farah called out. It can reconstitute itself, even from one.
Jason looked around the floor. The main mass of leeches had been incinerated, but many leeches had spilled onto the floor as Rufus and Gary stalled it. Salt bag tucked under his arm, he started flinging handfuls at the leeches while Rufus and Gary stomped them underfoot. While the leech mass had only recoiled from the salt, individual leeches vomited blood from their tooth-ringed mouths as they dried up and died. Eventually, there was nothing left of the leeches but blood stains and ash.
You have defeated Sanguine Horror. Quest, the Sanguine Horror. Objective, destroy the Sanguine Horror, 1 of 1. Reward, Sin Essence. Quest complete. 100 Bronze Spirit Coins have been added to your inventory. 1,000 Iron Spirit Coins have been added to your inventory.
Jason edged forwards warily. He noticed a leech that had managed to get far enough away that it was burnt to a crisp instead of being completely annihilated. He poked it with his toe.
Would you like to loot Sanguine Horror?
Jason gave his mental assent. Awakening Stone of the Apocalypse has been added to your inventory. 10 Bronze Spirit Coins have been added to your inventory. 100 Iron Coins have been added to your inventory. Jason looked at the listed Awakening Stone. Apocalypse. That didn't sound wildly positive. Chapter 14. Worlds Apart. Jason sat on the bottom stair of the chamber while Farrah removed the collars from Rufus and Gary. His whole body was racked in pain after using the last of his mana to conjure the cloak and float down from the top of the chamber.
"Explain something to me," Jason said. "If you can do..."
He gestured at the sections of wall and floor melted by lava.
"That? Then how did they catch you in the first place?"
"Ambush," Rufus said. "We were meant to resupply and get information from a local contact. Instead, he set us up for capture."
"We're going to go find him," Gary said.
"And have a sizzling conversation," Farrah added.
"But first," Rufus said, "we have to get back to the Vayne estate. They still have Anissa, and I'm concerned about the cultists that Jason lured away. If they left because they saw the tides turning, they're probably heading back to the estate."
"You think they'll use Anissa as a hostage?"
Gary asked.
"Possibly," Rufus said. "They might take her for leverage, or worse." After the collars were removed, Rufus and Gary started stretching, like they'd just woken up. Farrah, in the meantime, held her hand out over the ground and chanted something quietly. It was a short chant, only a few words. When she was done, a large chest made of dark brown stone rose out of the ground. It didn't break through the floor, but instead rose up through it, like a ghost. Farrah pushed open the hinged heavy lid and took out fresh clothes for herself, Gary, and Rufus. They all started changing clothes, with no qualms about stripping down to their underwear in front of Jason or each other. Jason glanced surreptitiously at the three of them. Rufus and Farrah had the bodies of Olympic athletes, lean, muscle-filled with the power of coiled springs. Gary was so huge he made bodybuilders look like they were still under construction. His wild mane and leonine features completed his majestic appearance. Jason didn't know what passed for handsome in Gary's species, but he suspected Gary was it.
"Why am I the only one who isn't super good-looking?"
"What?" Rufus asked, looking over as he pulled on a shirt. Jason thought back to the beautiful Cressida Vayne, standing next to the ordinary-looking High Priest Daryl, and was struck by an unpleasant revelation.
"I'm the Daryl," he said, disconsolately.
"What are you talking about?" Rufus asked.
"Doesn't matter," Jason said, shoulders slumping gloomily.
"Clothes are fine," Farrah said, "but we need to get our gear back."
"I just hope the ones who left didn't go back to the manor and swipe it all," Gary said.
Watching the others change clothes reminded Jason that he had completed the quest to get a shirt. That was 2 cages and a shovel to the head ago. He stood up and pulled the shirt from his inventory, discovering it was a plain, white t-shirt, complete with what looked like machine stitching. Holding it out in front of him, he read the text printed on the front. "I went to a magical alternate universe, and all I got was vast cosmic power." Jason shook his head.
"This must be what insanity feels like."
"What does it say?"
Gary asked, moving up to examine the shirt.
"You can't read this?"
"It's not in any language I know."
"Probably for the best," Jason said, as he pulled on the shirt. "You have equipped starting gear, outfit. Outfit tab has been added to your inventory."
"Outfit tab?
What?"
Gary asked.
"Nothing. Never mind,"
Jason responded. Jason checked his inventory, which now had a second screen he could access with a tab at the top labeled Outfits. He was now used to navigating the screens with a thought, and opened the new section. It showed a silhouette with various slots for equipment, most of which were empty. There was also a column to the left, empty aside from two entries. The first was listed as starter gear, the second as new outfit. How does that work? He muttered to himself. Help. Outfits. You can designate sets of gear as outfits, allowing you to quickly switch between them. Outfits can be modified by adding or removing items from item slots. An outfit can only be equipped so long as all items in that outfit are in the inventory or already equipped. Huh. He noticed the others were all watching him stare into the distance and mumble to himself.
You all right there, Jason?
Gary asked. Sure, Jason said. Actually, now you say it. He'd been pushing through on a potent mix of panic and adrenaline, but now the immediate threat was gone, he was starting to crash. His wooziness came back, his vision going dark and blurry. He stumbled forward, dropping to his hands and knees, as his empty stomach again tried to heave out what wasn't there. The next thing Jason knew, something was being splashed over his face. Sputtering awake, he was helped into a sitting position and a glass bottle was shoved into his hands. Drink it, Farah said. It's just water. You can't take any potions for at least a couple of hours. As Jason slowly sipped at his water, he looked over the icons he could see at the edge of his vision. The health silhouette showed a warning yellow all over, with a more ominous orange on his head and midsection. The potion cooldown icons were also present, but were completely greyed out. There was an icon for the mana toxin, with more than 2 hours listed under it. While Jason was taking stock of his miserable condition, the others were recovering theirs with stamina potions from the magic chest. After drinking his, Rufus made a sour face. Oh, that was sickly. What happened to the other potions? Gary chose the flavor, Farah said.
I think it's nice, Gary said, defensively.
Me too, Farah said. Rufus only likes things when they're bitter. After letting him rest a while, Gary pulled Jason easily to his feet. Jason wavered, and Gary held him upright until the dizziness passed. Thanks, Jason said. I've passed out 3, 4 times today. I think my brain might be bleeding. We can't use potions on you anytime soon, Farah said. But once we get Anissa back, she can heal you. What are we waiting for then? Jason said. They left the chamber through the huge stone doors. Jason glanced back behind one of them at the space where he had hidden. The tunnel was surprisingly long, carved directly out of the stone. Who made this tunnel? Jason asked. It must have been a tough job. Wouldn't be that hard, Farah said. Construction magic would make it a straightforward process. She looked up and down the extensive length of the tunnel. Might have taken a while, though. She acknowledged. They emerged from a gap that, at a distance, would have looked like a natural crevice. They were on the gentle slope of the lower portion of a mountain that tapered up to a towering height. The upper reaches were black and lifeless, while the lower portions turned to yellow stone and red earth, with patchy coverage of dry, yellow grass. There was a wagon outside the tunnel, wheels chocked to stop it rolling down the slope. It had a yoke for animals, but the harness had been cut, and the animals were gone. Did they scatter the horses so we couldn't use the wagon? Jason asked.
What are horses?
Gary asked. You've never heard of horses? The other three shook their heads. Then what was pulling the wagon? Jason asked.
Heidels,
Gary said. What's a heidel?
It's a work animal. The kind you see everywhere, Gary said. They pull wagons, carry packs. You can ride them. I can, too, but you can tell they don't like it.
Maybe the name is just different, Jason said. 4 legs? Hooves? Sounds right, Farah said. Long body? Jason continued. Long head?
Heads,
Gary corrected. Heads? Jason said. As in, more than one.
Yeah, 2 heads, scales, horns.
That sounds horrifying, Jason said.
We are definitely not talking about the same animal.
The animal doesn't matter if there aren't any here, Rufus said, which means we start walking.
Jason looked down the slope, getting a panoramic view of the land below. It was a flat, dry landscape of sandy yellows and sober reds, punctuated by withered grass or spiky scrub. Every so often, a low tree with sparse foliage would jut reluctantly up from the barren earth. The sun hammered relentlessly down over all of it, but the arid air was almost pleasant after the cloying humidity of the sacrifice chamber. The climate bore no resemblance to the moderate warmth and lush greenery he had experienced in the hedge maze. Even the heat had felt different there, more pleasantly warm than this unforgiving desert air. He remembered looking at the world map, a warped but not entirely different globe to the one with which he was familiar. It marked his position as being in the Kalahari Desert, which matched the terrain now before him. They started down the slope, Gary in the lead. He was wearing loose clothing to let air flow through, along with a hood to shield him from the sun. The others were wearing more fitted clothes, but didn't appear discomforted.
They brought us here while I was unconscious, right? Jason asked.
That's right, Rufus said.
How long was I knocked out for? This is very different from the place we were before.
They all turned to look at him with curiosity.
The Vane Estate uses climate magic, Farrah said. Didn't you notice when you went there in the first place?
Actually, how did you get involved with all this? Rufus asked, now that we have the time to talk.
I think I might have been summoned, Jason said. Not on purpose, obviously. I mean, who'd summon me?
I went to bed, which was last night, as far as I know, and woke up in the middle of the Vane family hedge maze. I sort of stumbled around for a bit until I found one of the residents, and from what I gather, he was trying to summon something and got me instead. He called me something that sounded specific. I don't remember what exactly. Otherworlder, maybe?
Outworlder? Rufus suggested.
Sounds right, Jason said.
Is that what the name suggests? Is this really a whole different world?
We've always been in this one, Rufus said. You'd have to tell us if it's different enough from where you came from.
Jason thought about the flying eels and leech monsters, people throwing around magic chains and streams of lava, healing potions, reading languages he'd never seen before, the magic powers he'd used for himself. All of it should be impossible.
It's definitely different enough, Jason said. My world has its share of strangeness, but this is a whole different kind of strange.
Some things are weirdly the same, though, like hedge mazes and people named Gary. I have a cousin named Gary, not as tall as you, Gary, but almost as hairy.
He's a Leonid? Gary asked.
I think it's a glandular thing. We don't have Leonids on my world.
I'm not well versed in astral magic, Farrah said. I've heard of outworlders, but it isn't my field of expertise.
Alternate realities, maybe? Jason said. Some things are the same, others different.
If that's what this is, then this world diverged from mine a very long time ago.
The continents are different, but not completely. The fundamental physical laws here have some interesting addenda. My world doesn't have magic at all.
Or a second moon. I did see a second moon, right?
Your world only has one moon? Gary asked. That's weird.
Chapter 15. Outworlder. They continued walking through the stony desert. There was a rough trail to follow back to the manor, and Jason's map ability had apparently been plotting locations, even when he was unconscious. The hard ground was uneven, but not too difficult to walk on. There was a stash of water bottles in Jason's inventory, provided from Farrah's own magical storage space. The pounding heat was not helping Jason's condition, and he emptied one bottle after another. Jason was grateful they were walking over dry, hard earth instead of trudging through endless sand dunes. His knowledge of African geography was limited, but he'd seen a documentary about Namibia's skeleton coast once, From what he could remember, things got very sandy there. Of course, it could be completely different in another world. The others helped introduce him to their world as they marched on. "What I don't understand," Jason said, "is why I have abilities that I never had before. Is it because my world doesn't have magic, but this one does?"
"I'm not sure," Farrah said. "I don't know much about outworlders."
"I've never heard of them before this," Gary said. "So don't look at me."
"I've met some before," Rufus said, prompting groans from Gary and Farrah.
"What?"
Rufus asked.
"Of course you have," Gary complained.
"What's wrong with that?" Rufus asked again.
"Your childhood friend is the Crown Princess of Vitesse," Farrah said.
"This again?" Rufus asked. "It's not my fault who my parents chose to socialize with." "So, Rufus is a big deal?" Jason asked.
"No." "Yes."
"Yes."
Rufus glared at the other two. "I do know a little bit about outworlders," Rufus said. "They've been pulled into our world from another one, through some magical accident. Usually a summoning spell that's gone awry." "The evil cult lady's son," Jason said. "He blamed me for ruining his magic thing." "That's how it usually works," Rufus said. "As far as I'm aware, I'm no expert." "This happens enough that there's a name for it?" Jason asked. "My understanding is that it's something that happens in high magic worlds like ours," Rufus said. "I really don't know any more than that."
"Is there a way to go back home?" Jason asked.
"I'm not sure," Rufus said. "If there is, it probably involves magic well above our level, let alone yours." Jason bowed his head in disappointment.
"Jason, tell me if this sounds familiar," Rufus said. "Do you have some kind of guide that helps you interact with our world? Something that doesn't fit our world but does fit yours? Maybe something you've heard of from a legend, or a part of your world's mythic traditions. Something that exists in your world as a story, but here has become real."
Jason thought about the video game interface he had been experiencing. The quests, the inventory system, the map he had open at that moment, even if the others couldn't see it.
"I think I know what you're talking about."
"That's something all outworlders have," Rufus said. "It works differently for every outworlder, but whatever magic that brought them here changes them. It gives them abilities to help them adapt and survive."
"That's why I can read languages I've never seen?"
"And speak languages you've never spoken," Rufus added. Jason frowned.
"Someone say something," Jason said.
"You didn't even realize it, did you?" Rufus asked.
Jason focused on the sounds rather than the words. It wasn't English. He didn't know if it was more disturbing that he could speak some unknown language or that he didn't notice he was doing it.
"I have an ability," he said, listening to the sounds he was making. "One of the effects is called language adaptation. Does that mean I can speak any language and not even notice?"
"Most likely," Rufus said.
"That's why you sound like you learned the language from a skill book,"
Gary said.
"I do?"
"You do," Farrah said. "There's a recognizably neutral accent, and things sometimes come across as odd, because of the difference in language structure. It's a giveaway, if you've seen it enough. Colloquialisms can translate very strangely."
"You're telling me the old lingo is hard yakka to get the noggin around?"
Jason asked. The others looked at each other in confusion.
"It seems there's a limit to the translation," Rufus said. "You might want to stick to plain language."
"Stuff that for a bag of chips," Jason said, laughing as three brows creased in confusion.
"I'd love to know how that got translated," he said.
They continued on, answering more of Jason's questions as they trudged through the desert. At least, Jason trudged. The others looked as comfortable as they would strolling through a park.
Outworlders like you might have their advantages, Farah said, but we natives have advantages of our own. Take Gary here. Members of his Leonid race are stronger and faster than us, and that's only the beginning of what Leonids can do. Elves are powerful spellcasters, and their skill with healing magic is unparalleled.
I forgot they were elves, Jason said. Some guy said he wanted to eat one.
That's not good, Gary said.
They're cannibals, Gary, Farah said. Of course it's not good.
What about dwarves? Jason asked.
Gnomes?
Non-copyrighted small people who live inside hillocks?
I don't know what any of those things are, Gary said. Except for hillocks.
We have elves, Rufus said. Leonids like Gary, obviously. We'll eventually be heading for a port city, so while this region is human-dominated, you'll see all kinds of people.
Each of which have their own special gifts, Farah said. Some are there from birth, while others only show themselves once you get essences. Humans like Rufus and I are kind of like you, in a way. Our abilities differ from person to person based on our essences. Most start out dormant, only awakening as we absorb essences.
That's not the only things humans get, though, Gary said. Humans have their essence abilities increase faster than other races. They're kind of annoying about it.
Do I get that? Jason asked. I'm human, right?
I have some bad news, Rufus said. You're an outworlder now, not a human.
I'm not a human?
Not strictly, no, Rufus said. You might be kind of human?
That somehow sounds worse, Jason said.
I met an elf outworlder, Rufus said. She retained some of her race's abilities, while others were replaced by her outworlder gifts. It's possible you might still have some human abilities.
Every race gets exactly 6 gifts, Farah said. There are ways of examining them with magic.
I can do that myself, Jason said.
You can? Farah asked.
No worries, Jason said, pulling up his list of abilities.
Racial abilities. Outworlder. Interface. Quest system. Inventory. Map. Astral affinity. Mysterious stranger.
I have a half dozen already, he said. I think these might all be outworlder abilities. Do humans normally get astral affinity?
Definitely not, Farah said. That's something Celestines get.
Celestines? Jason said. That's not something we have where I'm from.
They're similar to elves and humans, Farah said. One of the many new kinds of people you get to meet.
As long as none of them try to eat me, Jason said.
As they walked on across rocky desert landscape, the dry heat started to overwhelm Jason. His head throbbed worse and worse, until he was no longer walking in a straight line. They found a rocky outcropping to rest in the shadow of, Rufus helping Jason along. The others fetched out bronze spirit coins while Jason sipped at his water, laying back on the warm rock.
You don't need water?
Jason asked Gary. The enormous Leonid was covered in fur, which can't have been pleasant in the desert heat.
Gary's people require a lot more exertion than the rest of us to get tired, Rufus said. Another one of his racial gifts.
Also, when you have a full set of essences, you don't need to eat or drink anymore, Gary said. You can, of course, but it's just for pleasure.
To actually sustain ourselves, Rufus said, we need a concentrated source of raw magic.
He held up the spirit coin he was holding.
There are various ways to get it, he continued, but spirit coins are the easiest by far.
You're lucky I even had that water, Farah said, because we don't need it. I just like to be prepared.
If you're using coins, Jason said, what about the after effects?
Using those coins knocked it right out of me.
Rufus popped the spirit coin into his mouth. It's about not going over your limit, Rufus said. We're bronze rank adventurers, so a bronze coin will sustain us without stressing our bodies.
I don't know what that means, Jason said.
What? Bronze rank?
Gary asked. Also, adventurer? Jason said. Is that where you guys hang around in a tavern until someone hires you to kill 40 gnolls in a dungeon?
What's a gnoll?
Gary asked.
And why would there be 40 of them in a dungeon? Farah added. Is gnoll a kind of criminal?
There's an organization, Rufus said, forestalling more unhelpful questions. It's called the Adventure Society. They give out jobs to people like us, mostly to deal with monsters that are threatening towns, villages, or whatever.
But sometimes to investigate a cult full of bloodthirsty cannibals, Gary added.
As for bronze rank, Rufus said, that's related to your essence powers. Once you have all four essences, you become iron rank, and you can work your way up from there. Bronze is one rank above iron, but you can worry about that later. Reaching iron rank will fundamentally change you, make you powerful.
Not that powerful, Farah said. Not straight away, but you become partially resistant to attacks that don't have any magic behind them. You live on magic instead of food and water.
But my world doesn't have any magic, Jason said. Doesn't that mean if I became iron rank or whatever, and then go back to my home, I'd eventually run out of coins and starve?
You can get by on food and water, Farah said. It just takes more of it, depending on how powerful you are. Some foods are better than others. Meat, sugar, anything with magical ingredients, obviously.
Jason was relieved. He could handle living on protein bars and cake. Would he be immune to getting fat?
We owe you for getting us out of that mess, Rufus said. We'll help you find a full set of essences.
Well, I do have a couple of extras, Jason said, on top of the one I used already.
Where did you get those?
Gary asked.
I thought you only arrived in this world today.
I did, Jason said. I just kind of came across them?
Rufus raised a skeptical eyebrow.
You just came across them?
Yeah, Jason said. You know, here and there.
I can do an essence ritual for you, Farah said. Not before we find Anissa, of course. Who did the ritual for your first essence?
Farah's suggestion prompted some of the ritual magic knowledge in Jason's mind the skill book had put there. Remembering something he never learned in the first place was an odd sensation, like déjà vu. The new knowledge in his head told him that an essence ritual was required for a person to absorb an essence. Except, he knew from experience, that wasn't always true.
I didn't actually use a ritual, Jason said. I just kind of absorbed it. I think it was part of the same power that lets me speak all the languages.
What was that like?
Gary asked.
Just straight up absorbing it.
Strenuous, Jason said. I passed out.
Can I watch when you do the next one? Farah asked. She was looking at Jason like a scientist at a lab rat.
It wouldn't hurt to have someone watching out for you, Rufus said. We at least owe you that much.
I haven't even decided what I want to do, Jason said. I've been too busy trying not to die.
What's to think about?
Gary asked.
Who doesn't want power?
Hey, look, Farah said, pointing out ahead of them. I can see it.
As they crested a rise, they could see, in the distance, a strange patch of green in the middle of the desert.
Let's pick up the pace, Rufus said.
I don't think I can, Jason said. Under the harsh desert sun, he was sweating buckets, his skin tingling with the promise of sunburn.
Farah, get him another bottle of water, Rufus said. Gary, are you all right to carry him?
Wait, carry me? Jason said. That doesn't sound very dignified.
The others turned to look at him, and he looked down at himself.
The filthy skin and clothes, the stains from blood, muck, and sweat, the ridiculous shirt. Then there was the smell that all the sweating had turned from bad to egregious. "Never mind," he said. Chapter 16. Rescue Party. Rufus, Farah, and Gary raced across the desert, feet pounding into the dry earth. Rufus had told Jason they would be running at a sustainable pace. Their unflagging momentum confirmed his words, but they were moving at a pace that, in Jason's world, would be the equal of world-class sprinters. Jason had little time to think about such things, as they stormed over the rough ground at 10 meters a second. He was draped over Gary's back like a cloak, legs flailing as he desperately clenched his arms around the tree trunk Gary used as a neck. Any concerns over dignity quickly went out the window. His only objective became not getting thrown off. The edge of the estate grounds was startlingly apparent, a green line of grass and trees cut across the barren browns and yellows of the desert. Like stepping into a different world, a single step took them from scorched air and unyielding earth to cool grass and a welcoming breeze. They slowed down and stopped, just across the line. Rufus and Farah crouched, hands on knees, panting heavily, while Jason pawed off Gary's back to form a puddle on the ground. He groaned miserably as Gary looked down at him.
"You've built up quite a sweat for a guy who didn't do any running," Gary chuckled. Despite all his fur, body mass, and having carried Jason, he wasn't even breathing heavily like Rufus and Farah. He looked as comfortable as if he'd been lounging at a pool, rather than sprinting through the desert. Jason, sweating enough for both of them, raised his head to retort. He didn't care that his mouth was too dry for vowels, only regretting the energy he had expended to lift his head. He was happy to let it drop back onto the soft grass. Farah once again pulled her magic chest out of the ground. Retrieving a handful of potion vials, she handed one each to Rufus and Gary. "Stamina potions," she said.
"I'm fine," Gary said.
Rufus knocked his back without hesitation.
"I think he needs one more than any of us," Farah said, looking at Jason. "Too bad, really."
"He has water," Rufus said. Jason pushed his unwilling body into a sitting position and pulled a bottle from his inventory. He started chugging it thirstily.
"Life is hard, Outworlder," Rufus said without sympathy. "And you, my friend, are soft. If you want to get by in this world, you'll need to toughen up."
Jason struggled to his feet.
"How did you all handle the desert so well?" Jason asked.
"I was being carried and it broke me. I think I got sunburned through my clothes."
"How much do you know about the four attributes?" Rufus asked.
"I remember that there are attributes," Jason said. "Now that you say it, there's the strength one and some others."
"One of the others is recovery," Farah said. "Our recovery attributes are all in the upper range of bronze tier, so our bodies replenish themselves as fast as the desert can take it out of us."
"Unless we push ourselves too hard," Rufus said. Jason unhappily compared himself to Rufus, whose glistening sweat and casual poise made him look like a model for an athletics calendar. Jason, by contrast, looked like a rag someone had just used to clean up a spill. Replenished somewhat by the water and the rest, Jason took a closer look at the startling border between desert and garden. It was a straight line, like a border between worlds. A single step went from scorched desert earth to springtime in an English country garden. Looking along the border, Jason spotted pillars placed periodically along the edge, white stone columns with magic symbols carved into the surface.
"Are those things making it like this in the middle of the desert?" Jason asked.
"They're only part of it," Farah said. "It takes a large and sophisticated system to make something like this work." She handed out spirit coins to Gary and Rufus. All three popped them into their mouths.
"What now?"
Gary asked.
"Now we get to the manor house," Rufus said.
We find Anissa, and we kill everyone else.
I like this plan, Gary said.
Grey light started sparkling around him, growing thicker until it formed a full set of metal armor, encasing his entire body. It was thick and heavy, made from dark steel plates held together with large bolts. Engraved into the surface were runes that looked to have been carved out with a blade, rough but radiating strength. Where the engravings dug into the dark metal, red forged light shone from within.
That's impressive, Jason said. Isn't it hot in there?
Heat I can handle, Gary said.
After seeing him sprint through the desert like he was jogging on the beach, Jason believed it. Rufus held out a hand, around which motes of golden light were gathering. The light coalesced into a sword in Rufus's hand, an elegant scimitar that seemed as much a work of art as a weapon. The hilt was a vibrant red gold, as was the edge of the blade. The bulk of the blade was yellow gold that shone like the sun, with red gold inscriptions running down its graceful curve. After Gary and Rufus called their impressive equipment, Jason looked over at Farah.
All the stuff I conjure is made of rock, Farah said. I'm not carrying that lot around.
I'd conjure up my cloak, Jason said, but even if I had the mana, I think it'd kill me.
What can that cloak ability do? Rufus asked.
It gets bright or dark, Jason said unenthusiastically. It can also make me lighter, so I can jump from high places. Suddenly he perked up.
Oh, and it lets me walk on water, he said. I haven't tried that yet, though.
I have some magic boots that let me do that, Rufus said, then frowned. At least I did, until they were taken from me. We'll get our equipment back after we've freed Anissa.
Before sending away the stone chest, Farah took out two belts with heavy pouches. One was grey, which she handed to Gary, the other red, which she kept for herself.
What are those? Jason asked.
He watched Farah loop her belt into her clothes, while Gary tied it around outside of his armor. The heavy metal suit barely seemed to impede him.
Summoning materials, Farah said.
Summoning? Jason asked.
You'll see soon enough, Rufus said. Let's not tarry more than we have to.
They set off through the grounds. The outer areas were manicured woodlands, shaded gravel trails making their way through artfully placed trees and shrubbery. Somewhere he could hear the babbling of a stream.
This is nice, Jason said, looking around.
Indulgent, Rufus criticized. They should be working with the surroundings instead of against them. The cost of building and maintaining all this in the middle of the desert is beyond extravagant.
I know what you're talking about, Gary said. There's a desert city not too far from where I grew up. It has a subterranean river, and half the city is built underground around it. They use the natural landscape to their advantage. Hardly any core infrastructure requires magical upkeep.
Is that Zartos you're talking about? Rufus asked.
Wait, did you just say Zardoz? Jason asked.
No, Zartos, Rufus said. Is Zardoz a place in your world?
No, Zardoz is... Jason searched for the best way to describe it.
Let's just say it's for the best you didn't say Zardoz.
Have you been to Zartos, Rufus? Gary asked.
No, my brother told me about it, Rufus said. He said it was definitely worth seeing.
Knowing your brother, Farah said, he probably meant the women.
He's not that bad, Rufus said, prompting looks from Gary and Farah.
He's not.
Zartos has a large Celestine community, Gary said, but I suppose your brother didn't tell you about that.
He may have mentioned it, Rufus said evasively. In passing.
Celestines, Jason said. That's another one of the races in this world, right?
That's right, Rufus said. Like elves, they're famous for being attractive to human sensibilities.
We only have humans in my world, Jason said.
The idea of meeting whole new races is exciting. He slapped Gary on the back, which was currently encased in metal.
But you'll always be my first, Gary,
Jason said.
I like your attitude, Gary said. Humans have something of a bad reputation when it comes to other races.
I can believe it, Jason said. My world only has humans, and we're still awful to one another. My dad's parents came from a different country than where I grew up, so I look different from most of the people I know. People in my own country look at me like I'm a foreigner. Even the people who do look like me call me a banana.
A banana?
Farah asked. Yellow on the outside, white on the inside, Jason said. My mum's name is Cheryl. Why can't I listen to Pat Benatar without people turning it into a thing? The other three looked at each other, shaking their heads.
I don't think any of us know what that means, Farah said.
Probably for the best, Jason said. The cultivated woodlands were small, soon giving way to gardens of colourful flowers. The pathway continued out from the woods, weaving its way through the garden beds. Beyond lay the manor house, which Jason hadn't yet seen from the outside. Like the grounds, it was in the vein of a sprawling English country house. Three stories of old stone and dozens of windows, in the old money style.
I think that's the hedge maze over there, Jason said, pointing as they made their way through the garden. I woke up in there with no idea of where I was or what was going on.
That's where they found you?
Gary asked.
It would be nice if it was that simple, Jason said.
Quiet, Rufus ordered. We could meet enemies at any point. We have no idea how many were left behind, or if the others came back from the sacrifice chamber.
Are you sure I should be going with you? Jason asked. I'm not exactly an asset if combat breaks out.
You want to stay by yourself? Rufus asked.
No, now that I think about it.
Then shut up.
They moved out from among the flower beds and onto the lawn in front of the manor.
Seems quiet, Rufus said.
Use our summons now,
Farah asked.
We go quiet as we can until we find Anissa, Rufus said. We don't want someone deciding to make her a hostage.
Suddenly glass shattered as a person crashed through a second-story window. He landed hard on the ground, but immediately scrambled up and into a sprint. He was taken aback to find the four people looking at him, but didn't pause as he ran.
You think you can run from me?
A woman's voice roared from the broken window, prompting a laugh from Gary.
I don't think we have to worry about someone taking her hostage, he said.
Three spheres of bright light erupted from the broken window, spinning around each other as they pursued the fleeing man. He was bleeding from the broken glass and limping from the fall, but still moving faster than Jason could have managed. It still wasn't enough to escape the accelerating spheres of light, flashing white and gold as they unerringly pursued him. When they caught up, the spheres started spinning around the man, firing beams of light into his body. He let out a painful cry with every beam that lanced into his flesh, but he kept moving in the drive to escape. The orbs tenaciously followed his every movement, firing over and over until he dropped. His screams gave way to dead silence. The spheres vanished. The group looked back to the broken window, in which a pretty blonde woman was now standing. She stepped out into the air, light glowing under her feet as she delicately drifted to the ground. She started walking across the lawn to meet them.
Didn't you all say she was the healer? Jason asked.
That's right, Rufus said.
This lady here, Jason said.
The one with the death orbs?
That's her, Farah said.
Suddenly I'm less enthused about subjecting myself to her ministrations. Anissa was slender, almost frail-looking, with platinum blonde hair and pale skin. She was wearing a practical outfit of fitted pants and top, all in spotless white. Sturdy-looking cloth covered her from neck to boots, with thicker panels over vital areas. There was a belt, also white, with many small pouches, and a sword at her hip.
Even her boots were white, without so much as a blemishing smear of dirt. Her hair was cinched severely back into a ponytail, revealing ears that gently tapered to a point. She walked with lithe grace and absolute confidence, nodding her head in greeting.
"You got free as well," she said, as if expecting no less. "Why is there a vagrant following you around?"
Chapter 17. A Conservative Pillage.
"Aren't you the person that tried to get us out of the cages, but got hit upside the head?" Anissa asked, giving Jason a second glance.
"That's me," Jason said. Jason recognized Anissa's voice from when they had all been locked up in cages. He recalled she hadn't thought much of him, even then. She looked him over, her expression suggesting her opinion hadn't improved.
"He's lucky you were there," she said to the others. "I hope you didn't let him slow you down."
"Actually, he rescued us," Rufus said.
"I find that hard to believe," Anissa said.
"It was something to see," Gary said. "He's taken a few too many blows to the head, though. We've been dumping potions into him, but only a couple of hours in the desert left him a wreck. Any chance you could throw a healing spell his way?"
Anissa turned her gaze back to Jason. With a reluctant grimace, she held a hand out in front of his face and recited a short chant.
"Let the life that has withered return to full bloom."
"I think withered might be a bit harsh," Jason said. A soft light started shining from under his skin. The perpetual ache in his head turned sharp, the now familiar sense of magic healing, although the spell was far gentler than the potions he had consumed. "You have been affected by regenerate. Your health will be restored over time." An icon appeared in his vision, relaying the remaining duration of the spell. The injury indicator in Jason's vision was still yellow and orange, but over the half-minute duration of the spell, the health silhouette all cooled to a healthy green. His head had long been an overfilled balloon, threatening to burst, until the healing magic deflated it, to his great relief. He fell into a sitting position on the grass, letting out a long, satisfied breath.
"Thank you so much,"